Good morning. How are you? Very welcome to the show. You know, some politicians just have an instinct, I suppose you'd call it, for the perfect issue at the perfect time. So they just look at the situation, and Bernard Durkin looked at the situation. He saw a nation on the edge. He knew people couldn't take any more grimness. And Bernard Durkin knew exactly what we needed, which was an outbreak of complete foolishness. So, and the front of all of the tabloids today is about the lotto. What else? So the Irish Daily Mail, numbers up on lotto drought. Fine Gael TD, Bernard Durkin saying we need a full investigation and audit into the draw. Echoing Ronald Reagan's call to Mikhail Gorbachev, he added, Mr. Algeo, that's the head of the lottery, tear down those balls. And then independent Kerry TD, Danny Healy-Ray got involved. He says he thinks it would be very beneficial to have a smaller jackpot, be it 2 million or 3 million, rather than letting it run and giving all that money to one person. It's only harming some people to get a big amount of money like that. And this is good, that the lotto has been rolling over and rolling over for ages now. And I think it's at 19 million now and staying at 19 million. The Herald, TD says Shergar has better odds of winning Squid Game, and their headline, Quid Game, it's a lot of rubbish. The Mirror, it's a lot of balls. The Star, it's time balls were dropped. 23 weeks I see there, it's been rolling over. So that's the burning issue facing the nation today, the lotto. And this cover of the Sun then is the sad news that Dickie Rock says that he's finished. I've done my last gig, he says. His hearing has become so bad that he can't sing in tune anymore. And he realised that he was recording a show band's show recently, and he realised that he couldn't do it anymore. So he says, yeah, hope in the best traditions. He says he hopes he's left them wanting more. So that's the end of an era right there, isn't it? The Irish Independent on Saturday is petrol prices. Petrol is at 172 cents a litre and forecasts to rise further. I've seen it for more than 172 cents a litre. I think that's an average, and up it keeps going. And then the Examiner and the Irish Times are focused on, look, what is in reality the burning issue. The Examiner, health staff pushed to the brink, and they are quoting, you will have seen her yesterday on the airwaves, the chief executive of the University of Limerick Hospital Group, who said that the projections of up to 200,000 cases of the virus in December would cause the collapse of the health service. The collapse of the health service is what was being predicted there. And the Irish Times is saying, their headline, Mater medics warn of carnage if COVID-19 admissions continue to climb. And that's a look into the situation in the Mater, where things are, it seems to be quite tough indeed. And I suppose the idea of all this is aimed at scaring people a bit more than they clearly are, and changing their behaviour. So now let's talk to Professor Pete Lunn, who's head of the ESRI's Behavioural Research Unit. Good morning, Pete.
Morning, Brandon.
And Pete, you were on with us 2 weeks ago with your last research into public behaviour around COVID, and you have fresh research today. Before we come to that, can I ask you, I'm starting to wonder, do headlines like carnage, talking about the collapse of the health service, does it become a point where that's not helpful anymore? And does it feed a fatalism in people in a way, and they think, well, look, the thing is so bad, there's nothing I can do about it, kind of, and they start switching off?
That's a good question. So there is a strand of behavioural research, which is often referred to as doomism, whereby if people think things are too bad, you're right, it is possible for them to throw their hands up in the air and just say, well, look, what's the point, right? I don't think that's what's happening here. And I think in many ways, getting the focus onto the health service and hospitals actually looks quite sensible given the behavioral data. And just give me a minute to explain why that's true, because okay, I think this is pretty important, right? Throughout the pandemic, we had a situation where every time the case numbers went up, we could measure public worry going up with them. And that then kicked into behavior. People then changed their behavior as their worry increased, as the case numbers increased. That relationship changed It was clear as day in our data in the middle of 2021 as the vaccine program rolled out. That relationship changed so that when the case numbers went up, public worry no longer went up. Now, in many ways, that's a good thing because that's people understanding, or the very large majority of people understanding, that the vaccine is protecting them. And that's great. That's the benefit of the vaccine. But what we found since, therefore, is that the drivers of behavior are now different. Worry still matters, but the case numbers don't drive that worry. And increasingly what we see in our data, and particularly in the last few weeks, is that what people are worried about most is actually the health service and their friends and family. And I think changing the focus to that, because that's now primarily what the large majority of people, that's our target, if you like, that's the goal, is to get the pressure down on that. And that's why we need to change our behavior. And I think changing the focus to that is no bad thing. I mean, frankly, you know, any newspaper using words like carnage, I'm certainly not going to support. But changing the focus to the health service, I think is
carnage,
a good thing.
Carnage was a word used by a doctor who's there in the thick of it, so let's not judge him for that. So listen, the fear at this stage then, you know, they often say, like, fear is not based on the severity of the outcome for a person. It's based on the likelihood of something actually happening to them. Is it that most jabbed people look at those headlines and everything, and they do think for themselves, well, I'm not going to end up there. I'm not going to need an ICU bed. I'm not going to be in hospital.
No, because there's a third component to the fear. So when psychologists study fear, the other thing we find is that there's a really strong emotional component to it. So how you emotionally react to the kind of images and language that surround the particular prospect that you're thinking of, the particular thing you're worried about, matters too. And I think in the case of the sort of severity of what can potentially happen in ICU units and hospitals, that emotional fear is pretty strong, actually. So my instinct is that people are going to respond to this, and that what we're really seeing here is probably largely a belated response. But I should stress, I mean, our data, now the data were gathered last week before this week's announcement, but there have been some data gathered on Monday this week as well. So again, before the announcement, but pretty recent. We really haven't seen very much behavioral change at all so far during this wave.
Yeah. Yeah. You see, yeah, you wonder, are some people just thinking, oh, well, look, they'll lock us down at some point and sure, we'll stop then? Like, you know, back to that kind of fatalism a little bit. And you are seeing people, a big increase in this research in people wanting the government to do more rather than thinking about they themselves doing more.
Yeah, there's a lot in your question there. You're absolutely right, though. The question was asked directly to a representative sample on Monday, do you want more restrictions? And it was yes, 48%, no, 38%, with the rest don't know. So the public opinion has swung hugely. That hasn't been true all year. So the public opinion has swung hugely towards the wanting the government to introduce some rules and restrictions, which of course they did afterwards on the Tuesday. Yeah. But I think part of this, what I'm worried about here is it's impossible to predict the future in this stuff. Uncertainty has been with us throughout this pandemic. And it may be partly that what people are actually doing is they're carrying on with their planned behavior, things that they had already planned, but actually they're now planning a bit less for the future. And it may be that the result is that we see a sort of behavioral lag in people's behavior, that it just takes a while for the change to kick in. Now, of course, we've got to bear in mind we're in the context of Christmas, and that might, you know, have an impact on that as well. But it may be partly that. But I also think there's something else psychologically that could be important here, which is that where there are clear rules, in many ways, it makes the kind of social negotiation around this easier. I mean, one of the things that's so hard about changing your social behavior is just social pressure and wanting to reciprocate. We are social animals. And saying no to people is really difficult in these circumstances. You know, and it may be that sometimes rules and regulations actually help those conversations.
Give people an excuse to pull out of things, essentially.
Well, I wouldn't go as far as an excuse. I mean, almost just it gives them a kind of coordination point for the conversation. It makes you sound more reasonable to do something that in normal life would come across as disappointing to somebody or wouldn't be reasonable. And I think in many ways, the people who want the rules and regulations, and I don't think it's everybody, but the people who want more rules and regulations, it might be partly that it would make that easier.
Okay. Listen, you mentioned there the images and language and stuff, and obviously those things are all very important. And I wonder, look, I'm not saying that we shouldn't have a match tomorrow and that people shouldn't go and everything, but you do wonder about the imagery and what it symbolises, don't you? If on one hand, you know, people are being told it's carnage in the ICUs, you need to change your behaviour, but tomorrow we will see 1% of the population at a match together, and if the matches in recent weeks are anything to go by, they'll be largely unmasked, certainly when they're outside in the stadium. Does that feed a kind of a cognitive dissonance in people where, I don't buy into all this. Oh, it's mixed messages, it's too confusing. But when you see that, it's got to have an impact on people at the backs of their heads, doesn't it? That this is okay. So therefore, whatever I'm thinking of doing is probably okay.
Yeah. So the thing about the mixed messages is not so much that it's confusing. I mean, we do separate these things out in our analysis, actually. It's not that people are confused. It's the way you're asking people to make sacrifices for the public good. So you'll have heard me say this many times before. Everybody views this as a collective thing, and they're conscious all the time of fairness. They're conscious all the time, look, if I'm going to make sacrifices, everyone else should be doing it. So where they see contradictions of the kind that you're pointing out, where they see contradictions, it undermines that sort of collective sense of fairness that we're all trying to do something, because they're seeing other people do things that they're not doing, right? And that's what the problem is, right?
So
that's
what do you think about the imagery of the match tomorrow?
Well, on the match, I mean, you have to bear in mind, I think you have to balance against that perfectly reasonably that, you know, in this awful time, you know, getting the opportunity to watch sport and go to matches is really, really important to people. And I go to matches myself. I'm a season ticket supporter with a club and I go to games, right? What I do think, though, if I'm honest, is that we really should be wearing masks. And I think the organizations, the national governing bodies and the clubs should be telling supporters to keep the masks on. Because let's face it, it's not a really big imposition to wear a mask during a sports game. It just isn't. And I think they could be doing that. And I think the stadiums could be announcing that that's the expectation.
I think the Aviva do advise it, in fairness. I think I saw that in the context of last week.
So I've been to the Aviva to a game. It was advised before the game. You're absolutely right. But there weren't stadium announcements telling us to do it. And everybody actually did it the way they were kind of doing it in hospitality at the moment, which is people wore the mask into the stadium and then when they got to the seat they took it off. Now I don't think it's a huge imposition to change that, and I think if the people who are organizing the games and the announcers were really clear about that and clear about the logic of it, I think we could change that. And I think that would be a good thing to do, because I don't think it's a huge imposition, and the public health advice would clearly suggest that it's a good thing to do.
Okay. Pete, does your research also show that higher risk groups are kind of behaving in a similar manner to lower risk groups? They're similarly sociable and everything.
Yes, it does. So there's two groups in particular that we've looked at. So you will often hear talk in the media suggesting that young people are taking more risk than older people. Our data suggests that simply isn't true, actually, that older adults are at the moment as socially active as younger adults, particularly retired people, actually. There's a group of retired people who are very socially active and have a lot of social contacts. So that's what our data suggest. And you might think that's a bit odd, but the reason that comes across as odd is because young people's social activity is so visible. They're the people you see on the streets and in the bars and when you're out and about, whereas the social activity of older people is less visible. But we're measuring it, I think, pretty accurately, and it's pretty clear there's very little difference in behavior in terms of how many social contacts and the likelihood of close contact between younger and older people. The other dimension we've looked at is the vaccinated versus the unvaccinated. Uh-huh. The situation we see there is that people who are not vaccinated are behaving no differently from people who are vaccinated in general in terms of social contacts and the number of people they meet. But actually, unvaccinated people are less likely to wear a face mask. So actually, unvaccinated people are taking somewhat more risk.
Okay. Are you getting anything through on that? I don't know if it's something that you measure, but certainly I think everyone would say anecdotally that everyone you meet is getting more and more annoyed with unvaccinated people. Is that something you're finding?
We don't directly ask them about their attitude towards unvaccinated people. I wouldn't dispute what you've just said from what I pick up, but anything I'd say on that would be entirely anecdotal. Okay. I've got no data on it. But to a behavioral scientist, it wouldn't be a surprise. I mean, you know, again, it's that collective thing. If some people are free riding on the sacrifices others make and things others are willing to do, we find it very irritating.
Yeah. Pete, before you go, how can we change people's behaviour? I know you say it's possibly changing slowly now and in a delayed manner. Is there anything else we could be doing short of kind of more restrictions to change behaviour?
Well, I have no silver bullet. And I don't want to pretend for a minute I do. I mean, and I think quite often things are said that I think are going to work in the messaging and then don't. So, I mean, I'm guessing here, right? But one of the things I would do, actually, funnily enough, is go back to a conversation you and I had a year ago. I still think there is scope for people to socialize more outside. Mm. Or to, you know, do a thing where they say, look, let's meet up, you know, let's have coffee, let's have lunch, whatever. But if the weather's good, we'll do it outside and we'll only go inside if it really isn't. You know, I mean, I think that's, again, not a huge imposition, and it's good for people, and it's actually good for their mental health and so on. So I think we could get back to that message, especially over the Christmas holiday period. I think that'd be a really good thing to do.
OK, so I think we had the outdoor summer. You think an outdoor winter in so far as possible.
Absolutely, because it can be done. You just wrap up and you do it, and actually it's good for you. I mean, all the evidence suggests it actually makes you feel better, even if when you start off you don't really think you want to do it, and then afterwards you're glad you did. We're funny creatures like that. But the other thing I think is, if we want to preserve people's freedom and we want to we don't want to put hard and fast rules, you know, there can only be six people at a table, you know, this kind of stuff, then we've got to start to coalesce on rules of thumb that we all agree are reasonable. You know, things that allow us to have those conversations that reduce our activity. You know, even if it's simple things like, you know, when you arrange some kind of social activity, saying, look, it's perfectly okay to say no, I'd understand if you do. It's part of this is a kind of cultural thing. And if we want that freedom, that individual decision making, rather than a set of rules, we're going to have to find a way as a society to negotiate that, where we do it in a kind of fair way, where we're talking to each other honestly about it and actually saying, you know, look, it is okay to do less, to say no, you know, to not reciprocate a social invitation and so on, and to understand that and have that conversation. It's a hard conversation for people to have. But I think part of the problem here is that we view it too much as individuals deciding how much to do. But we are social creatures and these are conversations and people find it hard.
OK, but look, substantially, a year on, Pete, you're saying again, get a good vote for this winter. Back to that. OK, Pete, hey,
I was just going to say, it worked pretty well last year. I met a lot of people who said they bought themselves a better coat. If they didn't do it last year, do it this year.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? Some people might want to upgrade. A little treat for themselves. Get yourself a new puffer and get out there. Okay, Pete Lorne, head of the ESRI's Behavioural Research Unit. Thank you very much. Now, there's another aspect of this, of course. Pete says is good enough to admit he doesn't have a silver bullet. For a lot of people, the silver bullet is antigen testing. They get quite passionate about it. And remember last week we were a bit mystified at the CMO's kind of what seemed like a kind of a handbrake turn on antigen testing. So, according to today's Irish Times, at the Cabinet Subcommittee meeting on Monday night to talk about new NPHET recommendations and changes and restrictions, there was a lengthy argument, it seems from reading it, between the Taoiseach and the CMO, Tony Holohan, about antigen tests. And the CMO then, subsequently, even when it was agreed, the Taoiseach apparently made it clear, look, we are doing this, we're rolling out antigen testing. The CMO subsequently wrote to the Minister for Health, seeking to dissuade him from proceeding with the plan for rolling out antigen tests. And according to the Irish Times, he cited research that he said showed that the danger of people using these tests incorrectly actually risked increasing infection rather than reducing case numbers. And I'm joined now on the phone by Yvonne Williams, who's a GP at the Shannon Medical Centre in County Clare. Good morning, Yvonne.
Good morning, Brendan.
Do you share Dr. Holohan's concerns from what you're seeing?
Well, I suppose the biggest concern we would have is that the mixed messaging is sort of undermining the overall advice that we're giving as doctors and from the government. So people are getting increasingly confused because we're hearing different messages, and that is leading to confusion, lower levels of trust, and probably lower levels of compliance with other advice that we're giving out. So what we're seeing on the ground as GPs and practice nurses around the country is that the antigen tests are not being used properly by people. They're being used by people with symptoms to give them, I suppose, a negative or positive results, and people who are negative are then continuing to go to work or go to school or socialise, and people with positive results are often not going for the PCR test at all, and then we have no contact tracing happening. So we have entire families who have done antigen tests, who are symptomatic, who have all the symptoms of COVID, but they're not going to go for a PCR test. They don't see that they need to. It's not going to be of any benefit to them directly. And then there's no contact tracing for a very large number of people. So that's going to lead to an increase in cases when that sort of behaviour is going on.
OK, now those people are staying at home is what you're saying, but what they're missing out on is the contact tracing, such as contact tracing is at the moment.
You would hope so, but equally, I suppose a lot of the people who don't want to do the PCR test are people who don't want to wear the masks, and people who don't want to get vaccinated or aren't vaccinated as well. So it's the type of, I suppose, high-risk behaviour that you may have been discussing earlier there before I was on the show.
Yeah, and I presume if people use an antigen test and it delays them getting an actual result, a lot happens during that delay as well, doesn't it?
Absolutely, because look, we're very sociable creatures. So when you do an antigen test at home, or you're waiting to get an antigen test and a result, and you have those windows, those couple of hours, most people aren't staying in their bedrooms. They're mixing with the rest of the family. They're not isolating in their room. And we do know that not everybody does the antigen test correctly, but it's also leading to a delay in people contacting us or booking their PCR test. So people with symptoms, really, you want them to get the PCR test done as soon as possible and to be isolating while they're waiting for it. And people aren't really doing that with the antigen test. They're sort of a bit more casual about their approach to the test in general. So we've got the issue of people not isolating and then people not having contact tracing done, and also the delay then. Sometimes people are 5-7 days coughing before they ring us for a PCR test because they had a negative antigen test, and getting false reassurance from that.
And they're racking up. And this is despite everything we're being told about that they are not a reassurance. Like, I suppose what people will say is, well, look, the answer to this is an education campaign, and that people need more guidance on how to use them and how to do them properly and how to interpret them properly. Do you think, I suppose the CMO and people have an idea that it's too subtle for people to get, and that human nature is they will continue to use them badly. Do you think people can actually be trained to use these for what they are?
Absolutely. I mean, the HC do have a video on how to do the test, and they do have advice on, you know, parents supervising those who are between age 13 and 16. But, you know, we've had a lot of mixed messaging. I think the horse has bolted a little bit, and, you know, every town and village has stores selling them, and the HC doesn't have an approved list that I was able to find anywhere telling you what tests are the most effective and what tests are the most reliable. You know, there's nothing online for people to know is the $2.99 or $3.99 test as good as the $8.99 test. So that's something that should be done, you know, and that would help people, I think, as well.
Okay, and listen, people refusing to get PCR tests, you say, are likely to be the same people who are refusing to take a vaccine and that kind of thing. These are like general unbelievers in the whole project, yeah?
Yeah, there's just a general, you often can't, I mean, in my own experience, you can't get a specific reason for them as to why they don't want the vaccine. It's quite different to perhaps the pregnant woman who might be very concerned and feeling very protective of a baby and worried about a vaccine that's new, you know, new in the world, that hasn't been around for years. But the others, most of the people that we talk to, they can't give you an exact reason or any reason as to why they don't want to do it. They just don't want to do it, or they don't want to do it yet. Sometimes they'll say they feel healthy, they think they'd be fine if they got COVID, they don't believe that they would get sick or would end up in hospital. And I suppose ironically what we're seeing over the last month is that quite often they are actually ending up having to attend the emergency department with, you know, chest pain or coughing up blood, getting quite breathless. So I would appeal to anybody who hasn't had a vaccine, you know, the numbers are really, really high. They're well over what's being reported daily, because a lot of people aren't going for the PCR test. And we also have a lot of asymptomatic positive cases in the community we're not testing. So if you haven't been vaccinated, it is not too late. Please, please get one soon.
OK, Yvonne Williams, GP at the Shannon Medical Centre in County Clare. Thank you very much. And there are some of you texting think that people cannot be trusted to do the antigen test properly. Brendan, have you been to a shop recently and seen people with masks under their noses? Are we to trust the same people to do a very uncomfortable test on themselves? And then other people saying, look, Ireland has an educated population, says this texter. People are well able to manage antigen tests. The CMO was against masks, and they worked. If antigen test is rolled out properly, it will work. Antigen is being used across Europe. And that's from Luke. I wonder, is that Luke O'Neill? Okay, let's take a break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.